Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the 497th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And today, James, we're going to start, because we're going to talk about this intermittently over the next probably year or so.
Yeah.
Talking about nutrition. And one of the things that whenever I hear the whole idea of nutrition, it really strikes me that in many people's eyes, food is very close to magic. And when I say that, what I mean is, well, we'll get into why that is, but I have had patients who've twisted an ankle, have anything from a runny nose, you name it, and they'll ask me what they should do with their diet.
And your usual answer is cheesecake.
Well, I know what you're doing here, but the irony to that, or the ridiculousness to that, is any food that you pick at this point would be reasonable. So if you had jokingly said hard-boiled eggs, a glass of beer, a donut, a piece of cheese, a broccoli, you name it, because I honestly don't think there's any difference between any of them as far as your ability to heal a twisted ankle.
Yeah, no, exactly. And when you say magical, I mean, food, good food is magical. What we're talking about is, you know, whether or not it has magical properties, I think.
Yes, that's exactly right. Because you're right, many of us are foodies, at least in an amateur way. Yeah. We enjoy our food. Yeah. And so we should. But the idea that, and I think that you can, and we'll get there inevitably, that you can eat somewhat unhealthily and somewhat more healthily, and you can, there's certain studies, as you know, that suggest cardiovascular risk, etc., and we'll talk about that. But overall, the vast majority of, you know, whether I eat broccoli versus cauliflower or carrots, or, you know, which one's going to make this better for me, I don't think any of that exists. And I don't,
I think you're right, and that's why we're going to go down this path for a variety of reasons. I mean, one of the, and because of this sort of mythical, magical things that food has around it, is, you know, you and I have spent years looking at the evidence, and we've looked at the evidence of food, and it's probably the most tricky area to study anyway. And because of that, over the last probably couple of years, I've been sort of putting a book together, and I think you mentioned it in a couple of podcasts ago, to look at the evidence around food. Because, you know, you just mentioned what do you use for if you sprain your ankle, but, you know, there's so many recommendations. You know, are you supposed to drink 2, 4, 6, 8 glasses of water? How much how many alcoholic beverages are good for you or not good for you? And, you know, how many eggs a day? And should you be a meat eater or a vegetarian? Or, and, you know, the old adage, eating an apple a day. A glass of milk, should it be low fat, high fat? And there's so much stuff out there. And what we wanted to do is sort of go through the process of how do we even figure out if food is healthy? Because that's the nuance of where we have to start from, versus going to all of the studies. We have to talk about how we could possibly even figure it out in the first place. Because it's not that difficult to study to see if aspirin helps for joint pain, or if it reduces cardiovascular risk. Those are, they may be time consuming, but they're not difficult studies to do. But probably multiply that by 50-fold to try to figure out anything with food.
At least you can't turn a piece of broccoli into a placebo. You just can't.
Well, you can, but it's a hell of a big capsule.
Yeah, you might be one of those studies where you'd have to ask, can you tell whether you're on broccoli or placebo broccoli?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what we're going to do is just be maybe probably just a single podcast where we just go over the, how do we figure out if a food is healthy? And like I said before, it's not published yet, but it's coming up, a book called A Nutrition Proposition, where I go over a lot of this stuff, but also go over chapter by chapter all the different types of food that we have available and link it to all the evidence and have fun doing it, because it's kind of an interesting thing. But it's, you know, it's actually tricky to sort of search out and appraise all the best available evidence and then try and put it into context for you as an individual, because that's the nuance, right? You know, we've talked a lot about evidence, and we can have the evidence, but you still then have to put it in the context for an individual, because you are never going to be like that person in the study. And so it there's a lot of elements of evidence-based medicine in the way that we approach it, but it is quite a bit different.
Yeah, in fact, because of the way these studies are designed, and we'll talk about it, it's often, if you're even remotely close to the norm, and you probably are even when you think you're not, but if you're remotely close to the norm, you're not included in a lot of the analysis. You might be included, the type of person that you are might have been included in the study, but not included in the analysis.
Yes, yeah. And that's people are going, what the hell do you mean? And we'll get into that, because it's a nuanced point that we need to expand on, and we'll do that. But it's and you know, a lot of people go, well, what about the guidelines? Why don't we just go to dietary guidelines? And you know, many is the wrong word. Some guidelines have reasonable suggestions. But it's not necessarily based on an incredible amount of evidence. In fact, there's a number of people who suggest that they're basically evidence-free zones.
Yeah. And well, we know historically, and we've covered it as one of our previous podcasts, that, for example, when there was a beginning to recognize or accept in the literature that, you know, the saturated fats and all of that stuff, we didn't have a lot of evidence to have a hate on for cholesterol in particular, dietary cholesterol. The U.S., I can't remember who it was, James, USDA, I think, came out with an evidence review that said, yeah, basically cholesterol is not a nutrient of concern.
Yeah.
But again, what happens in all guidelines happens in nutrition. People are involved.
Yeah.
And so even if you can find a group of evidence reviewers who are willing to separate themselves from what the evidence, their belief systems from what the evidence actually shows, and they write that cholesterol isn't a nutrient of concern, inevitably it falls into the hands of the guideline writers and people like that who can't accept those kind of big leaps or changes and go back to saying, yes, it is a concern.
Yeah, no, exactly. No,
that's exactly what happened there. And that's why all of these things, guidelines and everything, get tricky, and it's hard. They're not as evidence-based as we'd like them to be.
And one of the big reasons why I decided to put a book like this together is because of every other nutrition book. know, because they
I won't say which one, but I remember when I was at university just starting out, a number of my friends were reading a nutrition book that was telling them, for example, that they couldn't eat certain fruits with potatoes. I remember that was one of the things I was doing at the time. And they were like, oh, you can't do that. And they were telling me you won't absorb them, which is, of course, ridiculous on the face of it.
Yeah.
But there was a huge following for this book series. And I, of course, was this outlier in my group of friends who thought that it was all BS. Yeah,
exactly.
And so, and these were all smart people.
It has nothing to do with
spelling of the idea is smart in and of itself. It uses enough science to sound plausible.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I can definitively say that any book that says this is the definitive food plan, you can't believe it. It's
definitively wrong.
Yeah. And you know, and really, ultimately, the only person who can say what is the right nutrition plan for you is you as an individual, because there's values and preferences that are so important. And so, what I've decided to do is put this book out when it gets published, and I got to do the cover and blah blah blah. Still, we're still a ways away. But the goal of the book is not to tell you what to eat, which is kind of weird for a nutrition book. I don't know if you've ever read one that doesn't tell you what to eat, because they almost all tell you what to eat. Mm-hmm. But what I want to do is have people think about, you know, what do we know about the evidence, so that you can make a decision. Because you know as well as I do, boy, people go, well, blueberries, they're so good for you.
Yeah, they're superfoods, right?
Yeah, everything's a freaking superfood. You know, it's done by reputable people.
Yeah, but it comes with the same kind of thing that when we did the review of Dr. Oz and so many other things, that words and language that's thrown around with it is given that it sounds impressive, but has virtually no meaning. Mm-hmm. Like, it's good for brain health. What does that mean?
Yeah, no. Clearly people would go, well, it's not you guys.
We should have been eating more blueberries.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, the caveat is that we can attempt to answer these questions, and we follow a systematic way of thinking, you know, evidence-based medicine or evidence-based practice or whatever you want to call it. We have at least an approach to how do we figure out, does this medical treatment work? And I would suggest that when you're eating food for health reasons, it's now becoming a medical treatment, if you will. I mean, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but that's the context, and we can do that. And I think if you're going to think of nutrition from a health perspective, you better know about the best available evidence. You got to think. I think clinical experience is also definitely somewhat useful in this area, but you've got to incorporate the values and preferences of patients, because if in fact there are some health benefits, you need to know the magnitude of that effect, because that should drive whether or not you would cut something out or add something to your diet. Because if it's a relatively small effect, you may not care enough about it. Go ahead.
That's true of drugs, right? That's true of drugs. We've dismissed some drugs because the effect is so small.
Yeah.
Why would we not also think, I'm going to get a lot of joy out of eating this, but not this, even though this is quote unquote healthier, because it maybe adds, you know, a 5% relative risk reduction or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. So that's sort of the approach that we're going to talk a little bit about. This will be the first podcast, and then we'll get into the more different food types and so on. But, you know, it's really actually interesting to go down the pathway of what is acceptable evidence when it comes to nutrition, because there's a lot of people that say, well, you just can't do randomized controlled trials. And that bugs me. You may not be able to always do them, but that should be your goal if possible, because of a number of the advantages of doing that. And, you can't do RCTs for everything, but that should be your gold standard. But even people who disagree with the standard of, you know, that we have for evidence of randomized controlled trials and then cohorts and whatever, even those people, when they look at it seriously, they consider things like animal research, mechanism of action, as insufficient evidence to drive anything.
Right.
And I think that's legitimate.
It is legitimate. And I think, you know, I agree with you. I think we should be trying to do more randomized control trials of diet. But we have to caveat that with a recognition that unless you're sequestering people, which would be virtually impossible. It's not impossible, but it's inconceivable.
Yeah.
Because you would need to sequester thousands of people to find real health outcomes.
Yeah. Well, there's been a thought that you could do that in incarcerated people.
Yeah, and they actually did some of that research in the past, even that was hard to accomplish, as you know. But questions like you've addressed, is it better to have 6 or 8 glasses of water a day? Well, we don't even have, you know, a trial of drink when you're thirsty or drink, you know, 8 glasses a day, and let's see what happens after 10 years.
No. Yeah. And we probably never will.
And I don't know that we need to.
No, I don't think we need to, because we have other things that we should be studying. But interestingly, and we'll get into this in a little bit, believe it or not, when you look at the number of, you know, large long-term randomized controlled trials of nutrition. There's only four of them, and we're not going to tell you the results of those yet, but there's really only four of them. And now there's a fair number on surrogate markers, as you know, like what does this do to cholesterol? Because you can assess those things quicker.
Oh, but for sure.
But there's only four that look at important clinical outcomes.
Yeah. No, it's regular to not have a lot of nutrition research. And so when people ask you questions about, you know, is broccoli better than cauliflower or things like that, or even when, you know, is, you know, this person is buying organic versus non-organic, goodness, it to really know what that answer is, I don't think we're ever going to get there. And for the same reasons we've already listed.
Yeah. And that's going to be the theme, as depressing as it is, as we go through this sort of stuff. But one of the things, and other than the surrogate RCTs that we just mentioned, what drives nutrition thought, if you will, are cohort studies.
Yes.
Really the backbone of nutrition research for a variety of reasons, because it's very difficult to do randomized controlled trials. So we do cohort trials. And for those of you who don't know what cohort trials, they can be either prospective or retrospective. So we either follow people forward over time or we look back in time. And what happens is you take thousands of people and ask them, how much of a certain food have you eaten over the last day, week, month, or year?
And so, wait, James, one thing here is that sometimes they do it just, what did you do today? And then they assume that mirrors what you did for what you'll do for 10 years.
Oh, yeah. No, exactly. It's much easier for me to remember what I ate yesterday.
Yeah.
But that's only one day.
Yeah.
So you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, because now if you ask me, what do I eat every week or every month or whatever, I'm basically going to make it up, and I probably will lie.
Oh, well, and that's the trouble with these, right? It's self-report. So there's lots of reasons. And even if you tried to randomize people to eat, again, let's just go to broccoli, a serving, whatever size, a cup of broccoli every single day for the next 10 years, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that some people aren't going to follow protocol.
No, exactly. And so we're never going to have those sort of RCTs. But then, so we do have to know, so with the cohort studies, we have to put those into context, because there's a lot of them. And they're not really easy to do, but they're a lot easier than RCTs. And there's thousands of researchers looking at thousands of questions for this sort of stuff. And what I don't know if people realize, and it was sort of what you talked about a little bit earlier, was what they do is you've asked people how much do they eat, and there's a science actually behind all that, you know, where they take what they say they are and then what they've eaten, and then they go, okay, we can, you know, what types of food are those, how much protein in them, how much carbohydrates, and they do all sorts of math and make it look very formal. And as best one can do, they do that. And then, as you know, they split people into how many people maybe eat this thing once a month, or the lowest percentile of people. And then they have maybe 2 to 3 times a month, or 1 to 2 times a week, or 3 to 6 times a week, or at least once daily. And then they use those groups and then do statistical. First of all, they follow people for 3 to 10 years and then count how many people get a heart attack, stroke, cancer, and all that sort of stuff. And then they do statistical testing to see if the once a month or less was different than once daily.
Just to understand, James, the people who did it the least and the people who did it the most are the ones that are compared. The ones in the middle, which are most people in general, they aren't included in the analysis, originally.
Yeah, very rarely. Now, there is a small number of studies that do sort of a dose response, if you will.
Yeah, but, or correlation data.
More of a correlation, so that you can sometimes see, you know, as you eat more or less, the line goes up. But the vast majority of cohort studies that are reported, when you hear that this is good for that, it's when you compare people who, as an example, never eat broccoli versus eat nothing but broccoli. So they're basically, basically rabbits.
Right, and so these, you can close your eyes and imagine the patient in your practice who is allergic to the mere thought of eating greenery versus the person who is absolutely dedicated to making sure it's 50% of every meal, some level of greenery.
Yes.
Those two people, if you close your eyes and imagine them in your practice, they're ever so subtly different in more ways than the consumption of greenery in their diets.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And now you're just starting to touch on what are the potential biases that are associated with doing cohort studies. Because, you know, well, first of all, it could just be a chance finding. And
yes.
One of my big concerns is that with thousands of people doing thousands of these, you're going to have a lot of chance findings.
Well, in fact, that was a landmark paper by John Ioannidis, right? It was his why most research findings are false. And there's a couple reasons in there. But the biggest one he says is when we came up with the 0.05 p-value, that was, you know, over 100 years ago, and it was based on a couple studies a year kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we've got a couple, you know, we've got major publications every single day, and then literally hundreds of other publications. Yeah. So the chances of getting a chance finding are very large.
Yeah, and that's why we strongly endorse repeating studies. And but you know, it's even that there's a whole political issue around repeating studies and all that sort of stuff. But you did touched on some of the issues of the sort of the confounding that can be done in these cohort studies, and in that the people who do different things in these studies may be just different. And now there are statistical manipulations to correct for them, but I think people take too much solace in that, oh, well, that fixes it.
Yeah.
And
they do these corrections where they adjust. The term is adjustment for the differences in people. So the person who never eats broccoli or anything green on their plate, they are more likely to smoke, they're less likely to exercise, they're all of these things.
Yeah.
So then you figure out what the risk of smoking, if 11% of the population more smokes in that group, then you have to adjust for that extra risk that they carry.
Yeah, no,
and all of those things. But you can only adjust for what you know, and you can't adjust for what you don't know. And you can also find things. I remember, and we've talked about this before, if I want to find something, I can over or under adjust based on the studies that I need to drive the factor by which I'm adjusting.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a game that can be played, and you can make one or two adjustments in your study, or you can make 50 adjustments in your study.
Yeah. And you know, it's not unusual to, when you make those just adjustments, that the actual difference falls apart. And vice versa sometimes.
Yeah, if they do the examination where they look what role that individual thing is playing on the overall outcomes, and this isn't done as often as we'd like, but when they do that, it's often the thing that we're questioning falls out entirely. No difference.
Yeah. And you know, I don't think we need to spend too much time, but there's all sorts of other biases. There's an observer bias. There's recall bias, which we've already talked about can you really remember what you ate? Because, I mean, if I asked you, what did you eat last Tuesday? You got no freaking clue.
And you'd have but you would want to remember that you were eating lots of vegetables.
Yeah.
Very sparingly in your protein / meat, or not sparingly, but being careful about your meat intake. And, you know, all of these things might be reported as, I think this is what they want me to say.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because, you know, there's a small number of people who just go, I ate this. Well, but most people are going to go, I don't want to look like a complete jerk or a complete idiot, basically.
I didn't have, you know, macaroni and cheese for lunch and cold pizza for dinner. So I'm going to say.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, that, in theory, if you ask enough people, maybe some of that recall bias can come up, but it's very tricky. And then, you know, there's so much things with, even regardless of the design of the trial, you have conflicts of interest in the people who are trying to figure these things out, because actually, correct me if I'm wrong though, Mike, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, when you do a cohort study, you very rarely say, we're going to look at this aspect of it. So you are often just looking at the data after you've gotten it and then coming up with sort of the answer. So you don't.
Oh, you're hunting. You're hunting. Anytime you're hunting.
Goodwill hunting.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's a serious concern. It's another thing that Ioannidis refers to, and many others, that you're just kind of hunting for things. And it's we've examined this before, James, and talked about it, but it's not unusual for a cohort study looking for relationships in age groups and gender and all sorts of things to have 400 different subgroups studied. Mm-hmm. And I know many of you are thinking, no, that's not possible, that we absolutely have seen it. Even Cochrane will have examined things cut up so many ways. It's not an, I think in antihistamines for upper respiratory infections, it was something like 70 something analyses. Yeah. So you're gonna, and those are in RCT data. Yeah. In cohorts, it's even more.
And you can statistically correct a little bit for that. But it's really important when we say statistically correct, it doesn't mean the problem goes away.
Yeah, you're just trying to move the bar so it's harder to make a mistake, but you still make mistakes.
Yeah.
And many people don't. The 400 one used a 0.05 for every single comparison.
Which is crazy making. And so then that's just the looking at the cohort studies. And then, you know, there's publication bias. There's whether or not it's reported in the newspaper bias. All of those biases come into play because if it's something really new that we haven't found before, it's more likely to get published. And then if it's really, really interesting, then it'll get into the newspaper and the TV and all that sort of stuff. And so it's really important to realize that though there's a huge bias there, and we're just touching the surface of the problems with this sort of research for the purpose of saying it is maybe why we cannot know for a lot of these things.
Yeah, and I think people have to understand that the confidence intervals around whatever we're going to talk about over this nutrition discussion, the confidence intervals are describing the statistical variability in the analysis, mm-hmm. but they don't capture the risks that you and I have just discussed.
Not at all.
Those confidence intervals basically go from zero to infinity.
Yeah. Or actually, they even go to minus infinity.
So it is a really, and yet this is what we're going, this is the best we have for the vast majority of questions around nutrition.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I know we're wrapping up this one, this podcast. So I'm going to bring it back and say, and yet there will be a lot of people who have a belief that certain foods really, really matter, almost to the point of having magical properties. Yeah. Like that if I eat, you know, more beef than pork, and if it's, or more pork than beef, then that'll make me better in this way or healthier in this way.
One of the things when we've talked about cohorts, and one of the things that you have to do is look at, very similar to with trials that, you know, randomized controlled trials is what was being studied. You know, are we talking about, is it more vegetables or less vegetables? Is it coffee? Is it tea? You have to obviously look at that. But then also what outcomes, right? Whether it's heart attacks, strokes, cancer. But sometimes it's things like people who are diagnosed with high blood pressure, or it's people who have elevated cholesterol. So there's a huge spectrum of outcomes that are looked at. And you need to know not only the outcomes that were studied, but who, in what population was being studied. Because if the population is quite dissimilar to you, it may have nothing to do with you. And and that's exactly what we do with randomized controlled trials how can we generalize it to a whole bunch of people?
Yeah, no, we're going to adventure down this path, but there are big caveats to what we're going to talk about, but this will point out, except for where we have RCTs that are consistent, we do have some of that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's going to be, this is the best we have. And it's not good, but it is the best we have. And it will arm people with the information they need.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and we joked earlier on about that kind of 5% relative difference. And people may be kind of like, well, it's got to be more than that. It's probably not for most of it. And remember that when you're looking at cohort studies, one of the rules of causation that you're supposed to look to is the size of the effect.
Mm-hmm.
And many people say that, well, we don't have an RCT of smoking. Well, smoking, the size of the effect was a 17 times increase in the risk of lung cancers.
Yeah.
In the case of food, when we find something important, and I'm putting in quotes important, we're often looking at a 1.3 times impact, like a 30% relative increase versus a 1700% increase.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's an important part. And I think what we can end it on this note in that, you know, so not only is it the type of study, it's not only what was studied, it's not who was studied, it's also the size of the effect. Because I agree with you, the size of the effect. So when you hear that this is good for you or bad for you, that is such a gross, there's so much lack of clarity there about what do we mean by that. And you're right. I mean, even in the worst, even the worst foods, if you will, and I even hate to say that because there's very few delicious foods that are worst, but you're right. Maybe you can get up to a 30 to 40% relative difference, but the vast majority of the things that you hear about are nowhere near that. They are in the 5 to 10%.
Yeah.
That's relative. That's relative, people.
Yeah. And it's frightening people and saying things like this is worse for you or this is better for you. I remember that about different types of fruits and vegetables in a guideline discussion that we had. And the difference was like a 6% relative with confidence intervals broad on either side.
Yeah.
And just thinking to myself, we're discussing a 6% relative difference and wasting time in discussion when smoking is like a 17 times.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, and when I say 17 times, that's 1700.
Yes.
By comparison to six. So and exercise is probably two to three times higher than that. So than the small effects of food. So it's really important to understand how poor the research is to tease this out, what we're relying on, and the small tiny effects that we're often seeing when we're saying one's better than the other.
And now what I want to make sure is that we're not saying that we should discount it all, because we can still at least look at it. And even when let's assume all of the issues that we've just mentioned are not an issue, we could then look at the things and go, well, even if these results were true, would that change what we would do? And I think that's sort of where we're going to go down in the next number of months, maybe over or the next year or so, is we'll go over different topics. So we will look at the evidence, but we wanted to make sure we framed it in the context of it. The evidence is already at an incredibly low level for most things. Now, there's a few things that's not, but those are few and far between. And so that's sort of where we're going to go. Hopefully you find that interesting. Anything else you want to add in there other than... I don't think we bit off more than we can chew.
No, I think the biggest thing is, while we're not saying that food is magical to cure a lot of what ails us, we're saying that the podcasts on nutrition are going to be magical.
There will be fairy dust everywhere.
Get your wands ready.
Exactly, yeah. So I think we'll just leave it at that. And that's sort of a teaser for you guys. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.